Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
So, Tom, I'd like to begin, if you don't mind, by talking about women and the role, really, and the impact of women in your life growing up.
Sure.
And namely, of course, one woman in particular, because I gather from your lovely Instagram post that your mother is one hell of a lady.
Yes. That is an understatement there. That is quite an understatement.
And she's 94 and
she'll
still going to shows.
She'll be 95 on October 1st.
Yeah, that's incredible.
God willing. Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, she's good. Mary Morello is a force of nature. I mean, she grew up in a small coal mining town in central Illinois, and the kind of town where no one leaves. And she left as a single woman, traveled the world for 20 years.
What was the drive? Was that just to see the world?
She can't explain it. She can't explain. I mean, I've asked her that many times, like, why of all the people of that town, how did the, you know, one of three siblings, a woman, you know, in, I think she left home in, she was born in 23. So right at the, around the end of World War II. I don't know why. You know, she doesn't know why. She says she has one history teacher who was kind of like inspirational, but that everyone had that history teacher in that class, and only one of them became Mary Morello. So, you know, she taught in Spain and in Japan and in Germany post-war, and eventually found her, after taking tramp steamers around the globe multiple times and have many adventures, found herself in Kenya, where she met my dad in the midst of the Mau Mau uprising. And she was there teaching at a school in the Aberdares Mountains, which was kind of where the Mau Mau were, and a residence where you couldn't go out at night for fear of leopards. So that's that's kind of the, I visited it. It's leopard heavy.
So we're talking outback.
You're in the bush. Yeah, you're in the bush. And, you know, and then while she was there, she, you know, met some of the people who were involved in Kenya's independence struggle. One of them was my dad. And
am I right in thinking that he was Kenya's first ambassador for the UN?
He wasn't the first ambassador. He was actually Kenya's ambassador to England for 8 years, but he was part of the first UN delegation.
Right.
And that's why I was born in New York City.
And was he, I guess, not present throughout your childhood?
That would be very accurate.
Yeah.
I met him properly when I was like 30 years old.
Wow.
Kenya.
Okay.
Yeah. And so that was a, you know, imagine. He was sort of a visage and a presence without ever really knowing who he was. But the good news is Mary Morello is no joke. And I was literally the only black kid in the town that I grew up in. And at the time, it was a place where my mom could.
And that's Illinois, right?
It's Illinois. It's a town called Libertyville, Illinois. And it was the town. She was, an overqualified world history teacher, given her travels and her intellect. But she couldn't teach at a lot of the local high schools because we were an interracial family. And they said, you can teach here, but because you guys are black, you would have to live elsewhere. And she thought that was not cool. So finally, someone vouched for us in Libertyville, and that's why I grew up in that town.
And so I'm assuming that politics and academia were both there for you from a very early age, if not always.
Without even thinking of it in that regard, those were like sort of parts of life. And and even though it was a staunchly conservative suburb, the politics of my home were very radical. And so I didn't really realize that the sharp juxtaposition till I was in high school and recognized that, like, I had a very different worldview than my teachers and most of the student body.
And did your mum actually teach you?
Yeah, she did.
My
senior year.
What was that like?
I was on my way out. You know, like I'd already been accepted to university, and it was like the last quarter of my high school career. And she was teaching African studies, which is a very interesting topic. But I'd be like, Mom, I'm going to skip class today and go practice with my punk band. I'm just letting you know. And she would be like.
And was she supportive of the music?
She was the The only house that would allow us to play there, yeah, and the which is very sweet because we were a cacophonic group that was probably not that pleasant for her to listen to.
Did you go to school with Adam Jones as well? From
he
Tool?
Was in the band. He was well, okay. He was in that band, the Electric Sheep. Yeah, he was in that.
Isn't
band.
That crazy how life works out? Because there's points in time I think where you can trace back sort of key bands of their generation to previous lives.
Yeah, yeah.
It's mad, isn't it?
It is mad. It is. It's so crazy that we're. When we were in a band and then had very divergent paths for years, and then we were in bands again later.
So you went to Harvard to study social studies, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Did you
like political science?
Think about pursuing a career in politics? Did you begin pursuing a career in politics?
Not politics with a capital P. I was a fired up, committed anarchist when I went to Harvard. I was going there to sort of intellectually arm myself for the coming struggle, not to seek elected office. But while I was there, an unexpected thing happened. I was a freshman, I was 19, and I had like a literal calling, like a religious calling to play guitar. I started playing when I was 17, but it was 19 where the skies opened and I realized that that was my fate.
What was the epiphany? What was the moment?
I don't know if there was an actual moment, but it was that year, it was where my ability started to catch fire a little bit. I was practicing. First, it was an hour a day. Then it was 2 hours a day. Then it was like 4 hours every day while pursuing an honors degree in poli sci. But I just felt like I think I could do this really well. And it was something, you know, in a world of like chaos, and there was sort of romantic chaos and racial chaos and
teenage chaos.
Teenage chaos.
As well.
But I had control over this, and it was the only deciding factor of whether I would sink or swim was my own will, and I had that in abundance.
I think there's certain musicians that appear, and you can't imagine them ever doing anything else. You know, there's like obviously Hendrix is one of those musicians that comes to mind.
Sure, yeah, yeah.
And Slash is another.
Sure,
one.
Yeah.
I guess it's almost a physical connection to the instrument as well. Inside, right?
It was really no choice. I mean, it really felt like it was not a choice that I was making. It was a choice that was made from the outside.
So you pack up your bags, you move west to
yes,
LA,
yes.
And you arrive what year?
Seeking my fortune in Hollywood in 1986. I left home in September 2nd, 86, and I arrived 36 hours later.
Talk me through that first, say, month in LA and what was going
not
on.
Not awesome month.
Musically
yeah.
at that
yeah,
time.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, I went out there with these lofty ambitions that I had it all figured out. I thought it's going to be like a city of shredding guitar, of Steve Vai's.
Yeah.
And I'm going to fit right in because I've been practicing my 8 hours a day and I'm going to get in a band of virtuosos and rock it to the top. That was my idea. That was not what happened. It turned out that was the period of like Faster Pussycat and bands like that.
Yeah,
which
Poison.
Which did not, it was very image heavy, a very particular image that I did not fit. And musicianship was not high on the scale of priorities. And I went and saw those bands at the local clubs. And I just thought, like I'm in trouble here. Like there's nothing in, like you have to be that in order to be, make records and to be a rock star and be successful. And there's nothing in me that can do any of that. I can't look like that. I can't sound like that. I can't pose like that. I just can't do any of it. And so those were challenging times. I also, even though I had a Harvard degree, I didn't have work experience. My only work experience was at the Renaissance Fair, so I could juggle. And if you wanted me to joust, I could probably, you know, hold a lance.
What's that restaurant called?
Medieval Times. Medieval Times.
You
probably
missed the trick.
I could have probably worked there, but so I had no money, and I was, you know, I was working. I was doing telemarketing. I had a stint as an exotic dancer. I had like some sort of.
Did
like,
you really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Sort of very.
What was your jam?
Brick House, of course. You kidding?
Commodores.
Me? Yeah.
Perfect.
Brick House. Yeah, that's the moneymaker right there.
Yeah. So I bet you saw some pretty crazy stuff. What was it like?
It was bachelorette parties.
It was bachelorette parties.
It was only bachelorette
parties.
That's where the money is.
Wow.
But anyway, so I did stuff like that, and while trying to figure out how to be in a band, and that was it was not evident at that point how to be I could be in a band. So I finally just joined the one band in Hollywood that would have me, which was not a particularly good band. It was a semi-talented singer-songwriter and who rehearsed us mercilessly over the course of 8 months to play these not such great songs. But it did open the door. While I was doing that, our buddy Adam Jones one night convinced me to go out to be his wingman to some club, and I saw a band called Lockup, and they became my favorite local band. And they were a different kind of band. They were a band that I had never seen before. They were from the east side of Los Angeles, and I became friends with people in their circle, and eventually they needed a guitar player, and I joined the band. And I was like, this is, it had nothing to do with the Sunset Strip. They didn't care how long my hair was. I was like a good guitar player and a nice guy, and there were drug addicts and prostitutes, but they were like kindly folk, and they were welcome. Like, who were they to judge? You know, like, we were all just kind of in this together, having fun making music as opposed to being driven to get a record deal.
And get laid.
Exactly, yeah, the stuff which was the Sunset Strip, and...
So I guess around 88, maybe even just before, a band called Jane's Addiction storms the gates.
Yes, they were.
And they changed the whole game.
Well, they
right?
were, you know, I would, before 88, I was sneaking into Jane's Addiction rehearsals and like sitting on the floor, and they had it together. They were the band, them and Soundgarden, though Jane's was ours because they were LA, they're the groups that redeemed hard rock music in my view, that they made it okay to be intelligent to trade in like nuanced poetry while being absolutely uncompromisingly metal at the same time. And those worlds never came together. Like, if you were smart, you had to like new wave or punk, and if you were metal, you had to like the devil, you
know?
And they
very black and white.
They dispensed with all that in a way that was a real revelation.
And they must have been at that point in time just so exceptionally dangerous and exciting.
Absolutely. It was
oh, sorry,
oops, that's right, no worries. Yeah, it was like nothing. They were my favorite band. It was like they were punk rock Led Zeppelin.
Yes, and they were like Led Zeppelin in the 90s, weren't they?
Exactly, they were. I mean, because they would have these long, beautiful acoustic sets in it, and you know, with Perry's very unique, almost like childlike voice and sort of twisted melodies and really penetrating poetry mixed with those huge, big, fat riffs. That was potent stuff.
Talk me through when you four, Tim, Brad, Zach, and yourself come together as one. And I imagine, maybe I'm over romanticizing, but maybe I'm not, was the chemistry instantly evident?
It was. Yeah. The first time we played together was August of 91. I think August 30th or 31st of 91. And we had, Tim and Zach had known each other for some time. Brad and I had played together. But when the four of us finally got in the room, it sounded like Rage Against the Machine, you know, like we would say that now where people like Rage Against the Machine, right? Nobody knew or liked Rage Against the Machine. It sort of sounded like that music, and it was fun to play. We had no ambitions of ever getting a record deal, no ambitions of playing a show in a club. We didn't think that we had the sort of ethnic, you know, like there was no multiracial neo-Marxist punk metal hip hop groups playing the LA scene. No one was looking for that band. Those bands were not selling tickets because there weren't those bands. So we just wrote this music for ourselves, but the performance in rehearsal had the same feral intensity as later live shows. So we just were like we're going to make a tape and we're going to like give it to our friends. I remember the first person that heard Rage Against the Machine. The first person. We were rehearsing in kind of like an industrial complex. This guy that was a worker, this Mexican-American guy was a worker. We'd sort of see him outside, and he's like, what are you guys doing there? He's like, we're a band, and we're practicing. He's like, can I hear? I was like, sure. So he comes in, he sits down, we play him a few songs. He's like, this music makes me want to fight.
<You're> like, right on.
I don't know, maybe we're on to something. We can play boxing matches or something like that.
Is it true that you put out a one ad saying, seeking socialist vocalist who likes Sabbath and Public Enemy?
Yes, I did.
Is that right?
Yeah.
And obviously you found the guy that...
Well, no, he didn't answer that ad. That was a couple of years before I met Zach, but eventually sort of all
took a while.
Rounded into shape.
Brad had his right that said, drummer that loves John Bonham and James Brown.
Yes, yeah, he absolutely did, and that's him to a T. Yeah.
I loved when you brought out that covers album. It was such a fitting end to an amazing, you know, run. And I think that everybody who didn't perhaps know bands like KRS-One or Devo
sure
got an insight into that like musical makeup that up the band.
That's right. Yeah, absolutely.
And Dylan and
EPMD, I think, is on there. And Dylan. Yeah, it's like the we drew from a lot of different sources to come with that heady stew.
Do you have? I don't know whether you get asked this a lot or whether you can even answer it honestly, but do you have a favorite record from Rages?
It'd be the
initial three.
I mean, my instinct is just say the first one, because the first one was made with such innocence and with really the expectation that no one was going to hear it. Like first records are, expectations were none, and we just recorded our songs. And at the time, I thought we kind of captured about 70-75% of what we were. And, listening back to it now, I'm like, wow, we must have been super good because that record sounds pretty great.
It's exceptional, isn't it? Yeah, record sounds great. And weren't a lot of the actual just demo versions of the songs what would eventually just make the final
album? Yeah. Bullet in the Head is the demo that made it onto the record, like just verbatim, which is pretty crazy.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary. Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
We've talked about the scene at that time musically. What about the sort of political backdrop and the world at large? Because around that time, you obviously had the Gulf War, like the end of apartheid, LA riots. Yep. You almost had those kind of early stages of that empty sort of promise that the neoliberalist political movement was
absolutely,
which I guess is why we now have Trump as well.
Those songs were written before that stuff. The day that we went to go record the record, we sort of had an aborted attempt to record the record with a guy who had, I think, engineered the Janes records. He lived in Calgary. As we were driving to the airport, the Rodney King verdict came in. So we had we had this batch of songs. We arrive in Canada. We turn on the news and we see our city in flames. And we're like we were prescient in a way, like no one even knew that our band existed, but Zach's lyrics had kind of hit the nail on the head about this coming conflagration that was then manifested as soon as their plane touched down.
It's mad. And I think the political message is right there at the forefront, but the reason that everybody, I think, loved that band then, and the reason why the records have stood the test of time, is because it's the sound of four guys having the time of their lives.
Yeah. And unapologetically melding these genres of hip hop, punk, and metal in a way that, while it had been toyed with before, that was a very, I think we harmonized those elements pretty well on that record.
Yeah. Right on. Yeah. I would absolutely agree.
Yeah.
In your mind, looking back now with obviously the benefit of hindsight, why do you think that band came to an end when it did?
Well, I mean, it was a surprise to me that that band didn't end every Tuesday. I mean, it was merciful in some ways that it ended, because it was not a sort of a pleasant time to be in the band. And while the shows never suffered, the records never suffered, it wasn't being in the band was not a great time. And I always imagined myself being in the same band for my entire life, but when the dissolution of Rage Against the Machine happened, it opened the doors to a lot of great things, to be in Audioslave with Chris Cornell, to do a Night Watchman career of four Americana records that I'm very proud of, to play with Bruce Springsteen, and eventually to, led to Prophets of Rage and this Atlas Underground record, things that have been so deeply fulfilling and made such amazing connections with other musicians and audiences that I'm very kind of, you know, grateful in a way.
The list of collaborators and co-conspirators is, I mean, even Johnny Cash, man.
Sure. Yeah.
That's got to be, I mean, I had Stevie Van Zandt on the podcast, and that guy and his sort of take on music.
Yeah.
And to work with people like that, just not only on a personal level and to learn from them as artists, but on a musical level to get in and sort of bounce off people like
that. Yeah, absolutely. And to sort of see how people work and to pick up. I think the first time I did something outside of Rage, I remixed a KRS-One song, and somebody asked me to do it. I was like, I don't even know what that means to remix a song. It's like, you go in and you put your music with his words. I'm like, oh, I can do that.
Right.
I can do that. And that really, you know, so from KRS-One to I've done metal to Pete Seeger, you know, the list prior. The thing about making this, making this current record is that I've had maybe hundreds of collaborations previously, but most of the time it's lending my talents to someone's show or to someone's record.
Yeah.
Whereas this, I'm on the Alessandro, I'm like, I'm the curator of this circus, you know, and while the collaborators are very diverse, there's a guiding North Star, both musically and thematically, that's my responsibility.
And so how do you go about bringing that team together? Do you just write a wish list and say, approach Steve Aoki RZA and
Jizza? It did start with some of the producers because I wanted to, you know, I had the lofty ambition of forging a new genre of music and combining the feral fury of my Marshall Stack guitar playing, big guitar riffs, crazy guitar noises and solos with the huge drops of EDM and taking kind of the electronic wizardry of now. I describe if my guitar playing is the black and white Ansel Adams photograph, what I wanted was to do the smashed Picasso version of that, where it's recognizable, but you hear it in a different way. And so I reached out to Knife Party. They were really my introductory drug to EDM. I'm not a fan of EDM. What I knew of it, I was not a fan of. And then when I discovered those guys, like, that's like great hard rock music. And
aggressive
and
exciting.
Aggressive and with the tension and release of the best Rage Against the Machine songs, you know? And so I called those guys up. I said, I got an idea. What if, I love the way that you guys make songs. What if we make a song where you replace your synthesizers with my electric guitar, but do it through the way that you arrange stuff? They're like, sounds like a fine time. And that became the first song on the record, Battle Sirens. And then Bass Nectar, you know, he was next. And we worked on a song for quite some time to find like sort of the right riff with the huge drop. And the thing that I found was Knife Party, Bass Nectar, Steve Aoki, Bauer, Pretty Lights, all big Rage fans, you know, and that was
no doubt.
Certainly
and probably
arrows.
Grew up on that.
Yeah,
band,
yeah, exactly.
Right?
Arrows in their quiver. And that it sort of led them down a different musical path, but they could very much relate to the concept of the Atlas Underground.
Do you think you can still be entirely original working within just the rock format at this day and age?
I mean, I think you can never say never to that. And people are often counting rock out and often counting electric guitar out, and they haven't been right yet. So I suspect they're not now. One of the things that this record can function as is a Trojan horse, and that it can introduce a radical poetic perspective and searing electric guitar to places where they currently do not exist, which is the dance floor and the charts.
Yeah,
you know. And one of the things that frustrates me is like a lot of young people are reaching only for the laptop and Ableton rather than practicing 4 hours a day on the guitar because there's no guitar on the top 200 songs. And so by working with Marcus Mumford and Portugal the Man and
great band,
great, and some, you know, some other artists without compromising one iota with regards to the rockingness or with the politics of it, to be able to have the Trojan horse come through the gate and go, there's more to the picture than you've seen before. Yeah, it's possible to rock and to think as well in both the mosh pit and on the dance floor.
It seems to me, if you look back throughout time, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, up to, I guess, the turn of the millennium, everything that was going on politically fed into popular culture.
Sure.
And you'd have pop music, of course, but it would often be radical and thought-provoking.
Sure.
And it does seem like popular music of today is kind of brainless.
Yeah.
Why do you think that is?
I think it would be an accurate assessment. There's certainly plenty of music that's being made that is not brainless, but it is not. It's
popular
not,
you know, and in
yeah,
the
yeah,
charts.
If you look at like the Spotify top whatever list, it's not there.
Yeah.
And the most you can hope for is like maybe an anti-suicide song or something like, which is very worthwhile, but it's like, yeah. It's not like this thoughtful commentary on contemporary events wrapped in great songs, which popular music has often been in the past.
And let's be honest as well, both our countries are arguably in more of a mess now than ever.
Exactly, exactly. Which may explain sort of a turn towards escapist music.
Perhaps,
but
yeah.
Also, escapist music also accelerates the problem as well by sort of providing, you know, like the bread and circuses of now to, you know, if we're taking pills and we're on the dance floor, let's not worry about the fact that the seas are rising and 300,000 Sri Lankan refugees will soon be in Malibu, you know. so, I mean, as to why there's a sort of turn towards the vapid, I honestly don't know. What I do know is that I have a greater commitment than ever to turning that tide, at least within my own world, and making a record that can go beyond artistically and audience-wise, go beyond the confines of where my music's been before. You know, it's really like, I feel challenged and excited when I do something that doesn't feel safe. When I went from, first of all, making Rage Against the Machine, that did not feel safe, and that felt like I grew as an artist. Then stepping into Audioslave, where we've got this huge sort of Soundgarden camp and Rage camp that they're coming together, and half of everybody's mad. That felt very unsafe in a way that was fantastic. I made a lot of great records with Chris Cornell. Then in doing sort of a Dylan in reverse at Newport, where
Judas,
where I abandoned the electric guitar to pick up the acoustic guitar, you know, to make four records, which made every guitar magazine on the planet, you know, curse and, put me on a blacklist, to forming the super group of Prophets of Rage and now making this record. Like, that's what I like. Making safe music usually stinks.
You like being outside of your comfort zone.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I feel that I'm, by pushing myself as both a guitarist and as an artist, that's what it's all about.
Obviously, Cypress Hill and Public Enemy would have been huge for you growing up, mm-hmm. and to have that come full circle and now be, you know, rocking stages all over the world with two of the greatest to ever do it.
Yep.
What a thrill and a joy that must be.
It's incredible. And as the guy that writes the set list, to be able to sort of look at the possible rageification of the PE and Cypress catalogs, drawing on the Rage catalog and having a growing Prophets of Rage catalog, it's like, it's pretty awesome. Like, we play those festival shows and it's no joke. Like, we're out there to take names and numbers.
I saw you at Download, and I would say that is the best. What's the technical term for a band that's just below the headline?
Right. The second level or whatever.
Prophets of Rage are the world's best. That literally.
Yeah,
like,
you
have to be a world conquering rock giant to follow that.
Because otherwise,
good luck.
Yeah, exactly. And I like that stalking position too.
Yeah.
You know, I'm like, you play, you know, people have been enjoying their time all day and then we're going, okay, here's an hour of this and then good luck.
Yeah.
You know, like, yeah.
I love that you've embraced the sort of the 420 culture as well. Obviously, that's not your bag, but
no, it's not.
I enjoy seeing the interaction that goes on. And did you have like
it's
one of those
so
little
comical.
Masks?
Yeah. I've literally never smoked weed in my life, but I've ingested so much secondhand smoke being in the company of Be Real. Here's the thing though, Timmy and Brad have smoked weed from time to time in our acquaintance, but now they're in a band with Be Real. So they, you know, like sort of bro down.
Yeah.
And when we travel between hotel and the gig, there's the what we call the roaster van, which a number of the members are in, and then the Christian bus, which has me and Chuck.
Yeah.
We're catching up on our reading while those guys are off smoking away.
Amazing. Are you going to be doing any sort of like extended tours over this side with the Atlas Underground?
Yeah. In 2019, we're putting that together right now. And the challenge is, you know, when you have as diverse artists from like Wu-Tang to Mumford and Sons to Rise Against, who are probably not going to all be at every show, is how to make a compelling evening regardless of who shows up or who doesn't. And I've been working with Sean Evans, who's the artistic director for Roger Waters' The Wall tour.
Wow.
For the Wall and for the Us and Them tour, and we've got some pretty cool and bold ideas to make a non-conventional experience that will contain the music but will go beyond it in a way that you won't miss anybody that's not there.
So I'm assuming visuals are going to play
a huge part. There will be sort of non-traditional elements involved, which will be cool.
A music video is something that still interests you, because I remember seeing, you know, videos like Wake Up back in the day
sure.
and just being blown away.
Sure.
Obviously, the money isn't you know,
yeah,
what it once was. So the budgets aren't what they once were. But is that still an area?
I hesitate
of the...
to tell you what we spent on the Cochise video. For
I'll bet.
Looking back, I'm like, you got what? How's
that possible? That was right at the tail like, end, I guess.
Built
right?
a house. Yeah.
So is that
it was right at the tail end?
Right at the tail end, one of just the parties
yeah,
over,
yeah,
guys.
Yeah.
But is that an area that still interests you and excites
yeah.
you?
Yeah, I mean the budgetary constraints are real though, and yeah. so you have to get very very creative to make something. That I remember sitting there's a show on MTV called 120 Minutes and like the lead video each week Sunday Night for 120 Minutes every alternative leaning person in the country was riveted like what's it going to be. And I remember when Rage had a video as the lead video and I thought like that's the ultimate. And now you know there's since we've been doing this interview there's probably 9,000 new
yeah.
You know, mumble rap videos have come out during that amount of time. So I like the idea. And you know, it's working with Sean, especially, who's a genius at the video stuff, of coming up with some broad concepts and let people who know what they're doing execute them for whatever the budget is.
Tom, I could talk to you all day. I think we're pretty much out of time. So I want to ask you one final question.
Yes.
If and when you're next in town, would you mind doing a part two with me?
I'd be happy.
And sitting down for another round.
I'm willing to guarantee it.
Thanks so much for your time, dude.
Thank you very much.
A real pleasure. And thank you for all your great work.
I see what's happening. I can read between the lines.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.